Hi, this is the Food Talk Radio Show, and each week we taste innovative new food and drink products, favourite bit of the job, and also we take a look at the latest in food tech from around the UK. Hello everyone, my name is Sue Nelson and I'm joined by the wonderful Guy Routledge. Hello Guy.
Good morning Sue, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. How have you been this week?
Yeah, not too bad. It's nice to be back. I've bought my radio voice today, kind of coming off the back of a cold.
But that's a sexy voice.
Well, no, you can't say things like that, otherwise I'll just keep coming back.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, excellent. Today we have some great guests, as usual. So we have Helen Graves from Food Stories, and she's a food and drink editor. You've got to go on her website. There's some really good stuff on there. So we've got loads and loads of things to say to Helen. She also develops recipes. Mm. And bearing in mind how, really, in terms of food, Guy, you just like tend to throw everything together, don't you, and see what happens.
That is the way I tend to do it.
That's the way you work, yeah. We might get some good advice off Helen. And then we've got Solviga coming along from Bump Mark. And this is a really interesting innovation to do with telling whether your food is out of date in the fridge.
This is something that I think it was quite a while ago that we first came across this, and it just looks... or it just sounds like a brilliant idea, and so simple. And yet, you know, sometimes the most powerful things are just so simple, but it's hard to get to that essence, isn't it?
Food waste is a terrible thing at the moment, and everybody's really struggling.
And a huge topic. Yeah.
Got to do something about it. I was looking this week, Guy, because I know you've always got your finger on the pulse, that the demand for organic is at its highest demand for a decade. Organic went out of favour for a little while, didn't it?
Well, yeah. I think with any kind of like food marketing and stuff, there's always a new buzzword to try and, you know, get people excited again. But no, it's great to see, because, you know, I always try and buy organic as much as possible, because I personally feel like the flavour is better, but I don't know if that is just a subjective thing or not.
I don't do organic at all.
Do you not? What do you do?
I'm much more interested in local food, I think. Mm. I do have an allotment.
Do you?
Mm, which is good for somebody like me, because I'm from South London, and we didn't have a garden when I was a kid, so I've been really... To start with, it was embarrassing, really, because I didn't know whether things were going to go down or up when he planted them.
Right,
you know.
Okay.
It was that bad?
Anyway, they needed to have an arrow on the packet.
No, so. Is it a downy thing or an uppy thing? Anyway, so I've gradually got better and better at that. And obviously, it tastes amazing from an allotment, but I think it's just because it's yours. But I am very keen on local, and very often local is naturally organic anyway, isn't it?
Cause it's, because you don't have that, you don't have the need to, you know, spray it with loads of chemicals and stuff.
But I didn't really see the point of having organic if it's actually flown 5,000 miles to get here.
Maybe that goes against it slightly.
Yes, indeed. So let's go over to Helen. So Helen, welcome.
Hello.
Welcome to the Food Talk Show.
Thank you.
I don't know what to ask. There's so many things I want to ask you. So many delicious things, yeah. Now, you're slightly different from our normal guest in that you're a freelance recipe developer.
That's right,
and
yeah.
What does that mean?
Amongst other things. Well, I've got my fingers in a lot of pies, basically, because it's quite hard to make a living as a writer. So I also do a lot of recipe development, and I do it for various publications, a lot of online, and a lot also for my own website, Food Stories. And my recipes, I suppose, are just inspired by... Well, as a cook, you get inspired by anything, really. Mm. It's more of a case of whittling things down, but by my travels, by, you know, things I eat in restaurants, by Southeast London, you know, inspiration can strike at any time, in the shower, on the bus.
So how does it work when you've got a magazine and they say, oh, we better shove some recipes in this month or this week? I mean, I know they use famous... You know, people obviously, yeah. but what does it mean? You know, what so they just come to you and go, oh, we've got 6 pages, will you fill that? Or how does it work?
Well, no, I mean, often they will have quite a tight brief. So, obviously, creating a recipe for a website or a magazine, when they've got something very specific they want, is much harder than when I can just create whatever I like on my own website. So they'll obviously, they might say we want a sandwich or we want something seasonal. So they'll give you a starting point. So you might start with, you know, a certain ingredient. They might want something light and summery or spring-like. There'll always be, you know,
so
criteria.
There'll be something. And then so somebody says, right, create me, I know Guy eats loads of sandwiches, so we'll go for sandwiches. Create me, a seasonal sandwich. You know, it's February coming up to March.
Yeah.
Do me the best sandwich you can. Is that, you know, what would you then do? Just be inspired by anything you might see?
Yeah, I mean, there might be an ingredient in season. So, for example, it might be something spring-like, like lamb. So you might have some really young lamb that you wanted to use. So I might do something, for example, say on the barbecue. some might do like a sort of grilled lamb skewers and then serve them in a pita bread with some yogurt and like a sort of Middle Eastern vibes.
I should have.
I wrote a book about sandwiches, actually, so you're my new buddy.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You wrote a book about sandwiches.
I did, yeah.
So is it prawn cocktail? Egg mayonnaise.
I think prawn is actually one of the most popular sandwich fillings in the country.
Is it really?
Apparently, yeah.
I'm glad it's not egg mayo, because that just, you know.
Do you not like an egg mayo?
I just think you could do so much more.
Oh, I love an egg mayo. It's a simple classic.
It's my favourite.
Oh, okay.
I've got cress in it as well.
Absolutely.
So you write these recipes for all sorts of magazines and websites, but you're also food and drink editor for Londonist.
Yes.
For those people who are outside London,
yes.
What is Londonist?
So Londonist is a website about London and everything that happens in it. And we have lots of sections. Transport is very popular. We cover, you know, anything and everything you can think of to do with London is on there. And I do the food and drink section. So it's restaurant reviews, it's, you know, area guides, it's anything to do with food and drink.
I've seen some great stuff on there where it says, why are there buttons to open the door on the tube?
Yes.
There's lots of silly questions like that, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, and there's, it's, you know, question. Why yeah, do you never see baby pigeons, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's, you'll find it all on there.
See, that's true as well.
Yes, think about it.
Yeah, have you got an answer to that one?
I think they just stay in the nest for a long time. You have to look at Londonist.
Your overriding project, though, is the Food Stories webpage.
Yeah.
And you've got sort of a blog under your name. And you've been doing that for 9 years, so you've been doing this for quite a long time. And I imagine you've seen quite a few changes.
I have. It's coming up to 10 years now. And when I first started, I was one of the very few food bloggers out there. Of course, now there are probably millions.
Millions, yeah.
And it was a very friendly place, you know, it was all lovely hazy meadows and we were all sort of chatted to each other. It was very interactive and a, you know, really nice place. And now the internet is a very different place, where, you know, I'm not saying it's sort of more toxic, in some ways it is, but people are very much start out with an agenda now and they sort of know their brand and they know what they want to do. And that's not how I started at all. I thought no one would ever read it and was really surprised when it took off, to be honest.
So you had like a meandering style to start with?
I did.
Because you could, really.
Yeah, I made all my mistakes online for everyone to see, and
well
you
done.
Can still see them on there.
I think that's the kind of thing that people really resonate with these days, because they want that authenticity and they want that kind of, you know, not just in their food, the natural and the organic. They want to see that in the personality of the people behind it as well.
Absolutely. I think that's really important when you have your own website, is that you let your personality come through, because there are, like I said, millions of food blogs out there. So
the things I was quite interested in is you've done some recent articles about sort of new dishes that you found. Now, I'm going to pronounce all of these wrong, just to let you know, so don't take the mickey out of me. What is turmeric fish banh mi?
That's right.
What is that? Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. So the banh mi is a sandwich. It's a Vietnamese sandwich that came about. It's a kind of product of French colonial rule in Vietnam. So it's a combination of French ingredients and Vietnamese ingredients. So you've got like French baguettes and things like pate and mayonnaise, but combined with Vietnamese pickles and coriander and herbs. Yeah, it's really punchy, delicious. One of the best sandwiches in the world, I would say. And I did a turmeric fish version.
Guy, you got to go for that. Turmeric fish banh mi.
It sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And turmeric is fantastic at this time of year as well, because it's got a lot of like healing properties and stuff. You know, I was reading something recently about it being, you know, possibly the world's most medicinal herb or something like that.
Yeah.
And delicious as well.
We've just been joined by Solvika. Hiya. How are you doing?
Hi,
you got a little bit delayed, but you've just made it into the studio now. So we're talking about all the wonderful recipes and things that Helen does. Have you ever heard, Solvika, of another one of Helen's, which is her search for the perfect sabish?
Sabish.
Do you know what that is?
I don't, but I actually have had banh mi, and I would agree that it's very good. I had it in my travels in Vietnam.
Okay, so what is sabich?
Sabich is an Israeli sandwich. It's like a pita bread. And it's got things like fried aubergine, boiled egg.
There's a bit of sandwich theme going on here, isn't there?
I do love sandwiches, yeah. It's got pickles and things and a mango sauce called amber, which is like a sweet and sour sauce. Delicious.
Turkish manti with lamb, garlic, yogurt and spiced butter. That's another one. What's a manti? So M-A-N-T-I.
Is it another sandwich?
No, it's not. Yeah, not this time. It's a dumpling, a Turkish dumpling.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I first came across them in Istanbul and they usually filled with lamb, but you can also get vegetarian versions and they're covered in sort of garlic yogurt and like a spicy tomato sauce.
Do you make these, so you taste things from around the world, you know, you
yeah.
you sort of jolly off to Istanbul as one does. Come back and go, I really Why like not? That now. How am I going to make it? Is that how you work?
That's exactly what happens, yes.
You must have lots of friends.
Lots of money.
Yeah, Helen's doing the dumpling thing and she's on version 13. Right, yeah. come
that
round.
Sounds brilliant. Yeah.
Is that how it goes?
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much spend all my money on food and travel, I would say. And there's not that much of it. So I have, an exciting life, but I'm quite poor, so it sort of balances out, really.
You're looking very well on it, I must say.
Thanks.
Another one I'd like to talk about, jerk spiced corn fritters with sour cream and hot sauce. Mm. I like a bit of a fritter.
Do you? Mm. I love a corn fritter. They fritter very well. I did that.
Is that like corn on the cob? Corn?
Yeah, like sweet corn. Yeah. It's really easy. Just mix it up with like a pancake batter and then just sort of drop blobs into the pan and they cook really easy. It's like a really nice brunch dish. But I'm really into jerk spice, which is something you usually see with jerk chicken, Caribbean flavours. So like allspice and spring onions, thyme, scotch bonnet chilies, that kind of thing.
Mm.
Sunshine flavours.
Yes. Getting very, very hungry here. Yeah. So now, your background, you're a doctor, aren't you?
No, not yet.
Doctor of philosophy.
Unless there's a medical emergency.
Doctor of philosophy and psychological medicine.
There we go.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've almost got a PhD. I haven't quite finished it yet. But
that's very impressive, isn't it?
I'm trying.
Very impressive. And you've got a degree in psychology. And I always hate sitting talking to people with degrees in psychology because I always think they're weighing you up.
No.
Because we're just talking about food and they're saying, this means so much more than
really
what you're saying.
It means so much more.
Definitely not.
Now, I know you've got a project on at the moment, which is you have a real big focus on improving the standard of the average barbecue. Is that right?
I do, yeah. I mean, the British barbecue obviously has a terrible reputation. Basically, what it is...
Is that because it's men that cook most of it? Is that
yeah, probably.
Sausage,
yeah,
you know,
I
they
feel
can't...
very outnumbered here. Yeah. Just, let the record reflect.
They can't talk and cook at the same time. basically, it's called Pit Magazine, my new project, and it's about not just barbecue, but about cooking over live fire. So it could be cooking mackerel in Istanbul on a tiny grill by the river, or it could be, kind of low and slow American barbecue, which is what people think of when they think of barbecue now. So I think we've come a long way from the classic British barbecue where people were like,
sausages
cooking
and
sausages,
burgers, yeah.
Exactly, burning sausages. And I think people are really into this low and slow style of cooking where they're kind of smoking pieces of meat and things like that. So we just wanted to do a publication that was, that has high quality writing, really good photography, and just, offer something different with barbecue other than the kind of, man-make fire, dude food image.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to say, and I was being a bit flippant, but there is that sort of image, really, of it's the only time where the wife doesn't have to cook because the man's out there and it's very prehistoric and macho.
Yeah.
And of course, that's a ridiculous generalisation, but it does mean that people aren't actually cooking very well, I don't think, and it's sort of sausages and burgers.
Yeah.
But we are getting this theme now where people are beginning to see barbecues as something that is a cooking sort of implement. That's not the right word, but you know what I mean. Where you can actually do so much more now.
Yes, I think that people are starting to realise that a barbecue is something you can manipulate and turn into quite an interesting way of cooking. So you can either do sort of offset barbecue cooking, which is where you cook things not directly over the heat. So you're sort of circulating the heat around.
Is that when you put
the
lid down?
That's right. Yeah, and it becomes like an oven, and you can cook. You can leave a piece of meat in there for 8 hours, as long as you maintain the temperature. Or you can cook directly, which is what we're used to in this country, where you have things directly over the coals. And I think there's this whole new world opening up, and people are starting to explore it as a way of cooking. Yeah.
And is that led by this sort of American? Mm. I mean, barbecue in America is huge, isn't it? Have competitions and all sorts of things.
Absolutely,
just unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's much more a way of life over there, especially in Southern American places like Texas, which is sort of home of really amazing barbecue. And
it's a bit difficult if you live in Grimsby and it's raining all the time.
It's a bit different.
Yeah, the weather is a real issue, isn't it?
Of course it is. Yeah, of course it is.
Although I have had an umbrella over a barbecue before. Then I tried to use it afterwards and it stank of smoke and it was just, embarrassing.
Are you a barbecuer guy?
I'm a big barbecuer.
Favourite dishes?
Some men have like fast cars that they name after women and, polish every weekend. I do that with my barbecue, quite sadly.
Do you?
What have you got then?
It's called a Swiss grill. It's about 2 and a bit metres long. It's got a rotisserie in the back of it, and it's got a gas burner to the side. It's an amazing bit of kit. It really is.
Big boys' toys. Sol, are you a barbecue?
I have absolutely no clue when it comes to barbecuing. No. I'm very happy making the salads and stuff.
Yeah.
But that can really make a barbecue. You know, it's not just about the meat. It's about all the things that go with it.
I think fish is amazing on a barbecue.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Really, really good. We got ourselves a bread oven.
Oh, yeah.
A wood-fired oven, which is huge. Mm. And I found it really interesting because it's really altered my perception of how you do cooking.
Right.
So, because you have to look. So it's all about what you see. So when you have stuff in the, you know, in your kitchen, it's like time, you know, timer and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Wood oven, you can't. It has to be because the temperatures change so much.
Yeah.
You have to actually look, you know, and place it different places in the oven. Got this amazing gadget thing, like a gun.
Oh, yeah, the laser.
The laser gun.
I've got the laser.
Yeah, so you can like fire it and like see where different temperatures are in the oven, which is great. But it tastes fabulous because it's a bit like charcoal or wood-fired barbecue. It's just all that beautiful smoke, isn't it?
And, yes.
And it really does add to food, I think.
It adds to the flavour, certainly. And like you say, I think there's something exciting about barbecue because it's a very intuitive way of cooking. So, you know, you have to just sort of trust yourself. I mean, you might have the thermometer, but, you know, you have it's quite exciting.
It's more involving, I think, because you do have to look and smell and prod much more than you would in an oven.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think get more involved, so that's good.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And so I sent my husband on this barbecue course because I thought, you know, you need to crack on and get a bit better at this. You know? So he went on one of these Weber barbecue courses.
Oh, yeah.
They had a great time, him and his brother. Anyway, when he was there, they cooked like puddings on the barbecue and all sorts of, you know, like a chocolate fondant. Mm. So it just shows. But I think a lot of that was putting the hood down on the oven. So it actually was an oven, not a barbecue, you know, whatever. Mm. I know you like your chocolate brownies, don't you, Guy?
We've been experimenting with brownies recently.
Need to do it on the barbecue next. That's your next challenge.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I've done a roast on the barbecue, but I've never tried dessert. So it sounds like an interesting concept.
Yeah.
Mm. So how did you do your brownies this weekend?
I was kind of lying on the sofa wrapped in a blanket because I've not been well recently. Mm. But my partner Kylie was busy away in the kitchen.
Oh, just hopeless, aren't they? Yeah.
I outnumbered 3-1. Yeah. We were experimenting with this new ingredient, which is called coffee flour. We came across it recently. And it's normally where you have the coffee bean, which they take out of this thing called the coffee cherry, which is like a much bigger thing, almost a bit like a cocoa,
coconut husk, isn't it?
A bit like the coconut husk or a bit like the cacao pod where you get the beans inside. And normally that just gets thrown away. But we came across this company recently who are innovating with taking that outer husk and kind of grinding it into a flour. So we bought some online, good old Amazon, came next day. And cooked it up into some brownies and they were absolutely delicious.
So does that taste like carob at all?
You said it was quite bland, didn't you?
I just tasted a bit on my, just like a bit on the end of my finger. Maybe it's just because I have no sense of smell at the moment. So I'm perhaps not the best person to feedback on the actual kind of taste of this thing. But yeah, it was well, like that kind of floury texture. But yeah, just a little bit bland initially. But, you know, when you kind of put it into the brownie, it kind of, you know, it seemed to take on some new kind of flavour properties.
Mm. Have to have a look out for that. There's loads of different flours now, isn't there?
Yeah.
Just to end this little segment then, I was going to ask you, you spend your whole time going and eating out, part of the job. Terrible.
It's awful. I struggle on. Mm, yeah.
I know. And obviously you've got to go to the gym all the time to try and offset all that weight. Favourite restaurants around London that you're really impressed with at the moment?
A place I'm really excited about at the moment is somewhere called Kiln, which is a Thai place. And actually they don't have any gas connected in their kitchen. They cook over these fires on these clay pots. It's sort of regional Thai food, which is becoming a thing now in London. So, you know, we're kind of used to, like, you know, fairly crappy Thai food. Mm. And now we've got this really exciting regional stuff, really interesting ingredients. And they do these clay pot noodles, which are fantastic. So that's somewhere I would definitely go.
Clay pot noodles. So how do they do that?
I don't know the details.
You're going to have to work that recipe up, aren't you?
I'll look into it.
Yeah. I really like Thai food. I think if you get really good Thai food, it's very, very subtle and some lovely, lovely flavours and quite clean tasting.
Yes.
Really, really nice. Yeah. Guy, any favourites of yours at the moment? Not necessarily London, of course.
I'm just trying to think where the last place I went out to was. My memory is not what it used to be, Sue.
I quite like a bit of tapas. So that's one of my favourite ways of eating.
I like that style of eating, yeah, where you kind of throw a whole load of things in the middle of the table and just pick and pick and pick.
Yeah, I do like Barrafina, though, although you do have to queue up.
It's fantastic. It is really fantastic.
Fabulous. And if anybody doesn't know, it's in Soho, and it opens at 5 o'clock in the evening. You can't book. It's just got a Michelin star, I think, hasn't it, Helen? I think.
Does it?
Yeah, I think so.
I can't remember.
Didn't want it to get
not
one.
Like it's my job.
Yeah, I didn't want it to get one because it's popular enough as it is. And basically, they've still got, you know, about 22 stalls sat around the bar properly. And then everybody's preparing food in front of you. It's really fabulous. And not a big menu, which is great. Don't like big menus. And, I mean, my favourite is their courgette flowers.
Yes, you know, they are stunning.
Slightly deep fried courgette flowers filled with goat's cheese and drizzled with a tiny bit of honey. Oh, you can't get better than that, can you?
Yeah.
So I'm a bit partial to a bit of tapas. Anything for you there?
Actually, one of my favourite restaurants, I mean, the food is obviously amazing, but the reason I love it is because of the amazing atmosphere. It's a place called Mes Amis. It's in Hammersmith, and it's just it just seems like you're entering this lovely family's living room and dining room, and it's been decorated with all these amazing cloths, and it feels like you're entering Aladdin's cave. So it's really atmospheric, and the food is absolutely beautiful as well.
What's the food, is it?
Lebanese. Yes, it's lovely.
Well, there's a really good restaurant in Whitstable, so that's in North Kent, which is an oyster bar. They don't serve any meat, so if you're vegetarian or you're a meat eater, you know, or you don't eat fish, you've had it because there's only fish on the menu, and I sort of quite like that actually. And that, when you walk in, there's 16 seats, and it's like you walked in your auntie's parlour. You know, they've got they've got this sort of, you know, sort of weird lampshades, you know, with the sort of like lacy bits hanging down that have been there since 1954. Got it. And, you know, they've got sort of, it's just really, it just looks like somebody, you know, your aunt's fireplace from the 1950s. But the great thing about that is not only is the food amazing, but you can bring your own booze.
Oh, great.
No corkage either.
Fantastic.
There's a lot of that in Australia and South Africa, or maybe, perhaps not as much South Africa, but and I think it's a brilliant idea because you can, you know, you can bring something that you know that you like to drink, and it's something of quality, and it's, you know, always going to be cheaper.
Yeah, but that's where restaurants make their money. I mean, it rather alters your financial model, doesn't it, if you can't
perhaps
do that. Well, thank you very much to Helen Graves of Food Stories. And if you want to see a little bit more about Helen, and she's got some really great recipes for a start, but also some great food writing going on, you need to go to helengraves.co.uk. Have I got that right, Helen?
I have got that right.
So helengraves.co.uk. Have a really good look at that. When we get back, we're going to be talking to Sol about Bump Mark. Now, you're really impressed by this, aren't you, Guy?
I am indeed. I'm looking forward to hearing all about it.
So this is a new innovation, and we like to do a little bit of foodie stuff, and then we like to do a little bit of innovation stuff. So when we get back, we'll be talking to Sol. Thank you very much. I'm at Food Matters Live with my producer here, Lucy Ellis, and we've got some lovely bottles in front of you that are actually really good fun, aren't they? They've got some nice sort of, I don't know, branding really, but they look really good fun. And the catch line underneath is stupidly healthy. And we've got three large bottles, one sort of kale spinachy stuff, then we've got carrot apple-y stuff, and then beetroot apple-y stuff. So we've got a really nice green and an orange and a beetroot coloured. And I really like the packaging. It's good fun. On it, it says cold pressed juice for the people, which appears to be a rallying cry. And I'm joined by Charlie Leet Cook. And he set up the company who makes these, Moju, with his partner, Rich Goldsmith. What is this rallying cry? That's my first question. And my second question is, why cold pressed as opposed to heating stuff? What's the difference?
Two good questions, I suppose. So first on, I suppose, our rallying cry is such that you picked up on our bottles. Yeah, cold pressed juice for the people is sort of one of our mission statements. It's about taking really healthy, premium, I suppose, detox cleanse program type juices that are normally quite expensive and out of the reach of the mainstream, and packaging them in a really fun way, making them accessible and at a price point that everyone can afford.
And what is that difference between cold pressed? What does it affect the sort of nutrition levels?
Yeah, so that, I mean, everything we do at Moju is to make sure that we get the highest quality product, basically the highest quality juice possible. And we do two main processes. So the first one, as you pick up on, is the cold pressing, and that's the extraction method. That's how we get the juice out of the ingredients, and that's basically using a huge hydraulic press to gently squeeze all of the juice out of it. The next stage is the high pressure processing, which is basically as opposed to heat pasteurization, which you were mentioning. And the reason for that is because heat pasteurization, you basically cook the juice at high temperatures, sort of up to 95 degrees. So by doing that, you get yourself a lovely long shelf life, which is great, but you also are basically sort of nuking all of the flavor notes, the vibrancy of color, and importantly the nutritionals that you've worked so hard to get out via that cold pressing process.
I like that phrase, you've nuked it, and I think that probably describes it. And the problem with doing that sort of heat pasteurization is because you nuke out the nutrition and because you nuke out the color, you then need to add color, and then you need to add this, and you may need to add that. So the whole process, if you think about it, is pretty bonkers.
Yeah. I mean, if people start, you start then having to fortify the juices with sort of various sort of supplements to get high vitamin readings. So all of our juices, it's literally, we say it's really simple. It's veg plus fruit plus nothing else. That's basically it. There's nothing artificial. It's 100% natural.
Okay, so those look great. And I believe you sold your first bottle in February 2015, and you've managed to get them into Harrods. Well done.
We did, yeah. So there's a we started February 2015 as the first ever bottle of Moju sold. It was a slightly different format to this.
Was it your mum or was it somebody important?
Mum's very important.
Mum's, I know your mum's important, but
yeah,
you know.
Just in case she's listening to this. We started actually making it in my mum and dad's kitchen, sort of 4 a.m. and running like 20 bottles a day out around the local village. And Moju sort of evolved from that. The launch with Harrods has been really big with us in October 2015.
You've got a lot to thank your mum for. I bet she's been really chuffed with you. Can you imagine letting you know, all right, yeah, sure, use the kitchen. Oh, all that fruit, yeah, you keep peeling it, mate. Oh, they've got a press there as well in the corner. Great, I bet she loved it. And also boys, I'm really sorry, but boys don't clear up properly off themselves. Not really.
Actually, we were pretty good, to be honest with you. So Rich and I both used to wear, we called it like suits and shiny shoes. In our previous lives, we worked up in London. And so when we set up Moju, obviously there was no salaries there. So I headed home and camped out with my parents, which after sort of 8 years of independence, I think was as big a shock as it was for them as it was me. And so Mum was actually pretty good. We kept a pretty clean kitchen, and that's actually why we used to get up at 4 a.m. make them, and then we'd be all done by 7.
Yeah, I'm not sure I entirely believe you. What's your mum's name?
Sheila's
absolute heroine. Right, let's get back to this. I bet she's very proud of you to get it into Harrods. So aside from your normal bottles of juice, which look great and really good fun, we've got some boosters now. These are becoming popular, I think, and they're about the size of nail varnish.
Quite a big nail varnish
bottle, but you know, roughly that size. Yeah. And they're called boosters. What's the thinking behind this?
So the boosters, it's actually something that we wanted to do sort of a bit early on than we have, but just with sort of the capabilities of bottles and the technology, weren't able to do. But the big idea behind the boosters is we wanted to move the cold press juice space on a little bit, because to date the sort of innovation within the category has been by using sort of more far sort of field ingredients that you know the general consumers don't really understand and know the benefits of. So the big thing on the boosters is they're about functional benefit, and I can see by the look on your face of having the ginger one.
I've only just had a tiny bit, and I'm guessing that you're supposed to like do it like a shot. And I haven't done it like a shot. I've just done it like a tiny bit. Right, Lucy, I'm going to make you do it like a shot. Let's see what happens to you. My eyes have just watered. Go on. Yeah, go on.
Okay.
Go on.
Well, don't challenge me.
Setting her up badly here. And?
Oh, that's lovely. Really, really nice. I feel very alive.
Makes my eyes water like hell. Sorry.
Yeah, so the big thing is, on, I suppose, like we're focusing on their the functional benefits. So we use, you know, ingredients that are proven and also people understand. So we launched the ginger one a couple of weeks ago, and the turmeric one there as well is going to be launched in January next year. So the ginger shot has already got an innovation award, which we're very proud of, on the day of its launch when we were at the lunch trade show a couple of months ago. Brilliant. And they've been absolutely flying.
Can I get a box of these because I want some?
I mean, that really has, wow, that's really pepped me up in a way that, either having very, very strong coffee or some type of spirit that you're not really allowed, you know, or you're drinking at 2 o'clock in the morning. Listen, try this turmeric one, see what you think, Lucy. That's another big, it's a massive hit, I would say. A massive hit of, wow.
Mm. Yeah. You can really taste them.
Yeah. And how are people using them? Are they drinking these in the morning, or what are they, or just during the day when they're flagging a bit?
They're really versatile, and it's actually something we're trying to push more and more. You don't just have to drink them as a booster shot as such. There's so many different ways that they can be drunk. So actually, on the front of this box here, where it sort of explains it. So the name booster basically first came from boosting a juice. So in the office, we'll sort of amp up our juice as such. We'll pour the ginger one in, or a bit of the turmeric one, to add a bit of zing. Also, with they're really good with a cold glass of sparkling water. It's like a genuinely healthy fizzy drink that's like packed full of flavour. Or just in a glass of still cold water. Or what's happening a lot in the office at the moment is like your healthy hot toddy, where you do them with a glass of warm water as well.
That'd be lovely. The ginger is a hot toddy.
Definitely. Wow.
Cold or sore throat or something.
Really nice. I mean, blimey, that's woken me up, I can tell you. And zing is the word. I think that's how I would describe it. Well, they're really good. You need to look out for them. Moju. Where else can we find them if we not happen to be around Harrods?
Harrods, Selfridges, Planet Organics, the As Nature Intended, and then we're in lots of sort of great independents and speciality coffee shops throughout London and beyond, basically.
And can you get them online, or do you have to get them in retail?
I was just about to say that as well. And also online as well. Yeah, so we've got an online shop, which we can send stuff out next day delivery.
Better give us that website address then.
www.mojudrinks.com. So it's mojudrinks.com.
Well, I'd recommend the boosters for sure, wouldn't you, Lisa?
I'm shortly going to go onto the website and order a whole box of the ginger boosters.
The ginger boosters. Thank you very much for joining us, Charlie, and well done, Rich Goldsmith, as well. So here we are back in the studio, and I'm joined by Sol Vega, which I think I've got right. I'm really sorry, I can't pronounce your surname.
No, that's absolutely
your
right.
Surname
well
is,
done.
Your surname is?
Pakshtaita.
Oh, that's why I couldn't pronounce it, sorry. Sol Vega, we're going to call you Sol, if that's all right, because
I
know you do Design by Sol. And actually, your website is designbysol.co.uk, so that's S-O-L, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And you've designed this thing called Bump Mark, because your background is in design and technology.
Mm-hmm.
We've already said that Guy's a big fan of this. Can you try and describe exactly what Bump Mark is, which is difficult on the radio, I know, but just try and explain what it is.
It's basically the first biologically accurate food spoilage indicator for packaged foods. So it's a label that contains a byproduct of the food group that we're trying to label, and that byproduct basically experiences decay at the same rate as the food that it's labeling. So our first version of the product uses gelatin, which is a byproduct of the meat industry, and it basically comes as a gel, which is a solid. And what we do with that is we set it over a layer of bumps that initially you can't feel underneath. So the whole label, you need to touch it with your finger, and if it feels smooth, it means your food is safe. And only when you feel bumps, that's when your food has spoiled. So because there's this solid gel on top at the start of these bumps, you're unable to feel those bumps underneath because it creates a barrier. And as the food degrades, as it's been exposed to temperature and humidity and that sort of thing, the label, the bump mark, is kind of changing as well. And at the end of its life, the gel changes to a liquid. So that means you can feel the bumps that have always been sitting there underneath, indicating that the food has spoiled.
So I get a lamb chop or something, and it's in a packet. What do I do with this label? How does that work? Do I actually put the label on the food?
So the label would actually, it would already be on the packet because it's been applied by the manufacturer.
Ah.
It's very important that it's applied at the very start of the supply chain. So that's the only way we can be accurate, because if it was something that you were to apply well, I mean, we don't know what condition that food is in when you're applying it. So it's very important that it follows the whole supply chain to make sure that there hasn't been any temperature abuse or that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I could have gone to Tesco's or whatever it might be and left my shopping in the back of the car for 2 hours and you wouldn't know exactly at what stage that was.
Exactly.
So you've got to work with manufacturers in order to make this happen.
That's right, yes, and we've been doing very well to do that. So actually, most of the companies that we're engaging with have contacted us, not the other way around, which is a fantastic place to be in terms of getting something to market.
So you've got one in front of you here.
Yes.
So I'm looking at
it. This is a spoiled one.
It's a spoiled one. So this is, it's triangular, and I'd say it's about, I don't know, 8 centimetres across, something like that.
The new one actually looks like this. So this is quite an old version that you've got there. So this is just so you can see what's going on inside once it's spoiled.
So the new one's round and it's about the size of a 50p piece and a little bit thicker than a 50p piece. And I'm feeling it now. So it's got a sticky label. You would then stick it on the packet, or the manufacturer would do that.
This is the top, so that would provide the instruction of how to use it. So it would read estimated use by, and it would give you a date. So, because I think the date being there is still important to plan your meals and that sort of thing. But it's just changing that communication and telling people that it is just an estimate and that's all it is. And then underneath it would have a message saying true expiry when you feel bumps. So it's just putting what the date is in context, rather than saying that, you know, it's a system that's been wrong and bad and we should get rid of it. I think it's something we can definitely work in conjunction with.
So you're giving somebody a sort of guidance, you know, ballpark figure of roughly when this thing's going to go off. Mm. And then it's up to you to feel. So what I do at the moment is, it says, you know, use by or sell by. And of course, I think, I haven't managed to eat that this week. I'll open it. I'll have a little prod. Kind of looks so wrong. I'll have a little bit of a smell. And then I'll sort of chance it if I feel, you know, whatever. And obviously, I'm sure the huge majority of people are doing that.
Well, I'd hope so, because so many times the dates are wrong in a way. Mm. I mean, obviously, you want to have better data around it rather than, you know, just, you know, hoping that it's you know, good for you. But I hope that people aren't, you know, just throwing stuff away because it's like, oh, it's, you know, a day past the use by date or something like that.
Well, unfortunately they are. It's actually most people who abide by the date quite strictly, as research finds.
So obviously not Guy, he's not your target audience, is he, honestly?
no, I love this kind of thing because it's so much more transparent, it gives you so much more information, and it's putting it in the context of where you're using and handling the product. So it's not like you have to go and download an app that scans loads of stuff and it's, you know, there's a massive disconnect. It's stuck to the packet.
And Sol, you really believe that most people are quite strict in terms of the sell by, use by dates and think, all right, especially if you've got children, I would imagine, actually.
So, I mean, we can just look at the statistics. So 60% of the food that the UK throws away is completely fine and perfectly safe to eat. So that it kind of points blame at these labels, which cause us to throw away food early. So all we're doing is to be honest, that date that will be on the bump mark, we're hoping that date would be actually extended to what we see now, because we know that it can last longer. So we're still not recommending that people would eat it past the new date, but we're just providing the bump mark just in case something does happen, because that's what people really worry about, that what happens if, you know, this was exposed to a high temperature and it's no longer safe. And I think people are looking for a more accurate system.
More assurance, really.
That's right.
And in terms of in the fridge or whatever, it's reliant on you sort of obviously having your stuff in there, having the date, rough date, but you still have to feel, is that right? And that's exactly what your technology's been. That's what you've been working on.
Exactly. So you'd still have to put your finger on the label to double check. But, I mean, this is... you'd probably want to use this in quite rare cases. Most the trend's going towards people shopping kind of more for the next couple of days rather than for the next week. But this is for those items that you've kind of forgotten about and you just want to double check and get reassured by. And that's when the real benefit kicks in, and that's where we'll save a lot of the food.
And can you tell me about the technology of it? Because I know you're trying to apply for a patent for this.
Oh, we've already applied.
Yeah. So how I mean, would you just sit at home and think, oh, I think I'll do this? Or you just got a bunch of really amazing scientists together? How have you made this happen?
So because my background is in industrial design, it's not in science at all. I actually collaborated with a chemist at my university because this is my final major project at uni that has now kind of gotten out of control.
Blimey, wow. I mean, I was a graphic designer. You're an industrial designer. I just drew a picture for my degree. But oh, no,
I'm sure
no,
it
no.
was much more than
not
that.
Not Sol. But... No, she's got a blooming chemist in for hers. I hope you got a first.
I did. But actually, I was quite discouraged to continue this project because it wasn't your typical, you know, piece of beautiful furniture project. It was something I thought that was a bit more interesting, that was solving a real problem. And a lot of my tutors were like, well, it's quite involving science and that kind of thing. So maybe perhaps you want to choose something
for goodness
easier.
The whole point of going to university, surely, is to encourage our best brains to be innovative. But, you know, if you went outside the box, oh, that's too dodgy.
There's a lot of pressure to get that first. And they were worried that perhaps I wouldn't be able to get a first with such a strange project. But I guess I was very pleased that I got my first. Mm. And I really see university as a place where you can really mess something up properly mess it up for the last time and be able to argue your way out of it and say why it didn't work and still be able to get a good grade for it because you've kind of learned something
through
that process.
Yeah, absolutely.
So straight out of university, even before my graduation, I ended up filing a patent for it, but I couldn't develop the laboratory work that was needed to prove that this concept works. So I now employ 2.5 scientists to make it happen.
Wow. So explain exactly what it is you're trying to make happen. So to me, it just looks like a round plastic disc. Mm-hmm. But presumably there's chemicals inside it, and that's what's making the bumps happen. So in not too technical a way, can you explain how that works?
So it's actually a very non-chemically way of making it happen. So as I was saying, that the main material is this byproduct that we're using. In this case, it's gelatin. And because it's a byproduct from the meat industry, it's actually really good at copying the way that protein-based foods already decay. Yes, there's a couple of things we need to add to make sure it's... Because we're dealing with a raw material that has natural variation. So we have to add a few things to make sure that it always does what we need it to do. But what we're trying to basically prove is that this gel inside will turn from a solid to a liquid at the same time as this food has spoiled. So we're actually applying quite classical shelf life tests to our label. They're just sitting in this the same space as the food, and we're just double checking that under all of the conditions that could possibly happen, that it'll still show the right time when the food has spoiled. So it requires, because this is a kind of a new technology area that I dreamed up at university, and a lot of other companies, they when they're starting out with a product, they kind of use established technology, whereas we have to start from like the groundwork and really establish this as a legit scientific area that would make sense and would keep people safe, because we would never want to launch a product that would compromise
people dying because you've got it wrong. Yeah, and that's probably not a good idea.
Not ideal for my first company.
Am I right in thinking that the bumps is just like a piece of molded plastic, and it's the clever bit is the gelatin that decays at the same rate as the food on top?
That's right. And I think for other food groups, gelatin would not be the best thing, best material to use. So if you wanted to, label potatoes, this would be a horrible thing to use because A, I guess it's not vegetarian, but B, potatoes are not protein based; they're starch based. Yeah. So you'd have to use a starch based gel. Mm.
So what you're doing then is you're almost mimicking that piece of meat. So
exactly.
You've almost developed a label which is a mini piece of that meat.
Exactly.
So that
it's a mini me.
It's a mini me.
Yeah. That's right.
See, that makes sense.
It's basically a label. The easiest way of explaining what it is, it's just a label that experiences decay at the same rate as the food. And the label and the food have the same expiry date.
So you've just got a little bit of the essence of the food in order to show it, you know, that it's decaying. And your example of a potato, if you were going to have a label for a potato, what you would have to do is you would have to mimic the starch and all the stuff in the potato in order to get the label right.
Exactly.
Cool, we've got a lot of product development to go then.
So just one question before perhaps we move on. Would it still work if we froze the packaged meat? Because the meat would freeze and prolong its life in the freezer. But would the gelatin freeze as well?
So gelatin in its natural state does not freeze very well, but we're working on things that we can we can alter the formulation slightly so it does do that. So our first version will not be freezable, which is okay because we're going to be launching it on milk first. But our second, and people don't tend to freeze milk too much, but in our second version it will be a freezable version.
Very cool.
So one thing at a time.
Bit of a brain box, don't you think, Helen?
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing idea. I mean, well done to you.
Yeah, makes sense, though, doesn't it? Yeah, this makes sense. Yeah. And I think as well, it's working with the manufacturers is key, isn't it? It's not a consumer product for you.
It's a business to business. So you have to kind of get all the suppliers and manufacturers on board and working together and playing nicely. So yeah.
I guess you also have to do a bit of education to consumers as well, so that they understand what this thing is and how it works, and maybe simplifying the concept so that it's easy for them to get on board.
Mm. Exactly. I think the need is being communicated quite well. There's a lot of awareness about food waste, so it's easy to get people on board, but there will have to be an educational piece about how to use it properly and to make sure that people trust it and they adopt it as part of their normal routines.
Yeah.
Guy, obviously you're a co-founder of The Food Rush, which is a great website and really interesting stuff. You've recently been doing some research and things on supermarkets and the future of supermarkets.
Mm, yeah.
Do you think people are going to buy differently than they have been? I mean, and Sol's already drawn attention to the fact that people don't go for what used to be called the big shop so much anymore.
Mm. Well, I think that, yeah, in certain aspects, well, certain areas of society, things are changing quite a lot. You know, there's different things available now. People are, you know, living differently. They're, you know, busier. Everything is digital. What's that?
They're busier.
Everybody is busier. I mean, I went to the food assembly the other day to pick up some farmers market type produce that we'd bought online, and I was like, I don't remember the last time I walked to go and pick up some food. You know, it just comes in a van and they deliver it, and it's, you know, it's all delicious and stuff. The habits of people are changing, and therefore the businesses, the supermarkets and the producers and also the innovators are reacting to that. And it's, you know, it's very interesting. Mm. I really hope that things like this take off, because it puts that power back in the consumer's hand to know categorically this thing is safe to eat or this thing is not safe to eat, rather than looking at a number and going, oh, well, did I freeze it on the day that I bought it or the week that I bought it? And, you know, was it, you know, as you said, exposed to heat or something? You just have no idea.
The thing for me as well, I mean, I'm not vegetarian, but I don't particularly eat a lot of meat, but it's a really big thing to kill an animal. I mean, I think it's a big, big thing to kill an animal, to eat it. So if you're going to eat an animal and kill it, you've got to use all of it, because otherwise it's a disgrace.
And to not waste it.
And not waste it, and not put it in some horrible food. But you should honour it, I think, really. And, you know, a big roast piece of meat with all potato, you know, that the whole family sits down to. I know this sounds stupid, but if you were a pig, you'd be pretty chuffed with that. No, you wouldn't, obviously. But you know, for me, you should be honouring it, because it's a blooming big thing to do that.
And I think so many people don't.
And then you should use everything.
Yeah.
And certainly, I wonder how much meat is actually thrown away, which is just awful. It's criminal, isn't it?
It's a huge amount. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say this, but I think Tesco wastes £1 million worth of meat, you know, every month or something, so they don't sell it.
No, they can't. It's awful, isn't it? So are you a meat eater?
I am a meat eater, but nowadays I am a lot fussier. Well, not fussier, but a lot more sort of aware of my meat consumption, actually, maybe a bit like you. So I am very concerned with where my meat comes from, and I try to eat less of it, because it's just not sustainable, really. And also, it's not really great for you to eat meat constantly.
I'd rather buy expensive piece of meat and only have that one once every 3 days.
That's exactly what I do.
Horrible, horrible cheap meat.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really important, just for the environment and for your own personal health.
So, Solveig, if I can just talk a little bit about you. You studied at Brunel University.
That's right.
Is this where you got your first? You must have been a bit of a superstar there. Or did they consider you a bit of a pain? Because you were doing something different to everybody else.
No, I think I wasn't a pain. They were just worried that I wouldn't get the grades that I was after. But yeah. I still turn up there and I help out with some of the
lecturer,
events that they.
Yes, I'm
a guest lecturer there. So that's a lot of good fun.
Your topic there was industrial design and technology.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is that? I mean, I'm a graphic designer by degree, my first degree, but that was admittedly 150 years ago. Industrial design is different, isn't it? Ergonomics is really important.
I mean, the easiest way of describing industrial design is just to distinguish it from what we call kind of arts and crafts design. So people who are making beautiful one-off pieces and that sort of thing. Industrial design, an industrial designer designs projects, products that are generally mass manufactured and are kind of functional. Everyday items and functional. I mean, they can be beautiful as well because, you know, industrial designers designed Apple products as well. So, or this pen or this pen pot was also designed by an industrial designer.
I get really angry if somebody doesn't look nice. It takes as long to design something badly as it does to design something well.
Well, we only
there's no excuse. There's no excuse to design. It has to, you know, form and function are really important.
Exactly.
But it's still, why shouldn't it look good?
I absolutely agree. And I think if something has been designed in the way...
you're a designer and it's bad.
I think if something's been designed in a way that it functions exactly the way it should with nothing added, then it will inherently be a beautiful item to look at with no like weird things jutting out of it that don't really need to be there. So I think, yeah, it's definitely the combination of that too is to make the world a kind of more high quality place to live, basically. That's my aim, to improve the quality of everyday life.
And ergonomics is really interesting because for me, I see quite a lot of design. Obviously, as a designer, I pay quite a lot of attention to design, how things work and what they look like. There's some really interesting stuff happening at the moment, isn't there, in that less able-bodied people can't necessarily use a chair or use whatever it is. And I think that we must get our designers to actually start to look at, you know, designing for people who can't naturally move in the same way as other people.
I absolutely
agree.
It's a
good discipline.
And I think, I mean, it's called inclusive design. And
oh, it's got a name now.
It's got it's a principle that just says if, I think OXO Good Grips is a really good example. So it's really wide-handled items that are super easy to use. And actually they were designed with people with arthritis in mind. So the principle is if someone with some sort of physical disability is able to use something easily, then it's going to be super easy for the rest of us to use. And I think that's a really good it's kind of moved on to from kind of designing for disability and saying this is the set products that you should use. And I think inclusive design is much more interesting in saying how do we include those people in the rest of the products that we use and into society, really. And that's the principle that I actually designed BumpMark with, because I actually started by designing it to help visually impaired people understand where their food goes off, because at the moment it's only
like,
visual.
Like a braille kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But very few visually impaired people use braille anymore, because screen reading technology is so good.
It's so much better, yeah.
So that's why it's a tactile label. And as it turns out, the retailers preferred it, because with the color, there've been color changing solutions that have been similar to this designed before, and the retailers didn't really like them because it kind of highlighted the fact that it was, you know, orange or halfway through its life by the time it gets to the supermarket.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
the fact that this is it just kind of drops off and it kind of shows you the bumps right at the very end. It doesn't really have that problem. It wasn't something I really thought about. I was actually just thinking it from the
colour
impairment.
You could be colourblind as well. That would be really awful, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
No, I've just seen it as red, but you just bought it.
Exactly.
Get it home and have to throw it straight away.
That's another reason as well.
Yeah. That's good. Okay, so ergonomics, if we sort of take that further and things looking beautiful, again, if we go to sort of restaurants or spaces that are doing food at the moment, any sort of places that really strike you as being beautifully designed? Because we really do have to do something about designing restaurants and spaces for eating, because they're just the same as they were.
They're a bit crap, aren't they? There's
a lot of tackiness
as well. They're just so bad.
I agree. I mean, I would love to say that I know a handful of beautiful restaurants, but when you're running a company, you don't always have the luxury of going to all these beautifully designed restaurants, unfortunately. And I kind of bring the restaurant to my own home, and I love to cook at home a lot. I cook from scratch. I can't even remember the last time I had a ready meal. But my home is nice to look at. So
we'll all trot around there later. I'll go around your house for lunch later. Helen, restaurants and spaces for food haven't changed that much. I mean, some of the furniture can be quite funky, but we haven't really revolutionised the way we eat or sit down and eat or do anything different, have we?
What do you mean?
Well, in terms of, you know, we're seeing amazing gadgets, aren't we? And all that sort of stuff. And we're getting quite a lot of people on the show who are looking at service and trying to make service better by using apps at the table and all that. Mm. But we're still sitting four people around a table and, you know, all the chairs are uncomfortable and all that sort of stuff. But nobody seems to be looking at any sort of different ways of sharing food or sitting down and having food.
I don't think there's anything major to sort of revolutionise with that, really. I think the main thing when you go to a restaurant is that you just want really good hospitality. And I think that's why the sort of iPad ordering systems and things are never really going to work. Because, you know, if that person doesn't come to you, you know, if you have a really good maitre d' at a restaurant, they come and they greet you and they make you feel welcome and it makes it feel like a special occasion. That's one of the most important aspects. You know, bad service can ruin a meal. So I don't think there's anything major to change. I mean, we're seeing a lot of sharing plates at the moment, of course. There's different ways of eating, excuse me, but not necessarily different ways of the restaurant flowing.
Well, we're starting to see a lot of big communal tables and stuff like that. I mean, you go into a place like Wagamama. I mean, I know, I wouldn't necessarily call it a restaurant.
Yeah, but I don't like other people. I don't really like other people, really. No, that's. I mean, I don't really. And it's fine.
It's funny, isn't it?
And then you go and sit next to some two-year-old kid who's like splattering everything.
I can't really do without that.
But it makes perfect sense because in terms of covers, restaurant covers and efficiency.
Exactly, it needs to be a flexible space. So, I mean, I quite like the idea of when you have like a little pod for two people, but that only works if you're two people and you want to have like a nice, quiet, kind of away from things kind of meal. Whereas, you know, a lot of that kind of fast casual style of dining where you want something that's better than fast food, but you also want to be able to sit down and, you know, have that flexibility of the space. Those big kind of long trestle tables and stuff, it kind of works well as a flexible...
I do get very, I'm going to have a little rant here. I mean, Helen has a little rant section on her blog.
But I like a rant.
My real rant is badly behaved children in restaurants where somehow the parents feel quite fine to sit at a table and just let them run around as if it's a playground and ruin everybody else's meal. I mean, I just can't believe how ridiculously selfish that is. Yeah.
I mean, so the iPad ordering is maybe not what we need. Maybe we just need more iPads in front of children.
Although I want them to take, but my kids always came and the whole point of that was that everybody interacted and talked
with each other. Yeah.
Sit down, you don't get down from the table and you have a chat.
One thing that annoys me is people who don't dress up for restaurants anymore, really, and I'm not saying like put on your like gown tiara that you'd wear to like, you know, the Oscars, but I think when people are just wearing kind of sportswear to restaurants, I find it quite insulting to people who can't afford to eat at that kind of restaurant every week and have really saved up to go for that experience, and it kind of just says that, you know, your experience doesn't matter to me, and it's I think it's just a bit disrespectful
of
the fact that for some people this is a big deal and it is a big occasion and they have gone out for a big birthday party and you're just sitting there in your sportswear because you can afford to go every day.
So there
you
go, Guy. No more sitting there in your shorts with no top on when you're at I don't know, Claridge's.
I think there's an underlying point here.
You're going to upset a soul with that one.
I think there's an underlying point here, which is that basically the most annoying thing about restaurants is other people.
That's what I said. Yeah. Want to go in and it's just me and my friends, so
sounds perfect.
Anyway, this has been a really good program as usual with the wonderful Helen Graves and Solvega, very clever lady. Bump Mark is this new incredible technology that Solvega's been developed, and you can find out a little bit more about that on YouTube. Nice little video there. So presumably if you stick in Bump Mark and
it'll come up. Bump Mark food spoilage, something like that.
Yeah,
but or
up.
You can, the easiest thing is to go on our website, www.designbysoul.co.uk.
designbysoul.co.uk. And if you want to, it's very good. And if you want to read some of the really great things that Helen's written, let alone all the photographs of all the recipes she's developed, which is definitely a good look, you need to go on to helengraves.co.uk. Ready for next week then?
No doubt a busy week ahead. I need to look at my calendar. I have no idea what I'm up to.
Well, we hope everybody has a lovely week. We can't wait to have our food talk show again next week. And if you want to find out a little bit more about us, please go on to foodtalk.co.uk. You can download, I think we've got about 80 or 90 podcasts now. And if you want to give Guy any abuse or comment on anything food related, please tweet us at Food Talk Show.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.